My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. From seemingly nowhere, over the summer of 1995, the legend of El Chupacabra was born. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by author and investigator Nick Redfern to discuss this most perplexing creature and his updated Chupacabra Road Trip book. Nick has visited Puerto Rico several times, and we cover just what happened to cause such fear amongst the population of Puerto Rico. Nick's thoughts on both the original creature and the arrival of a very different animal in the southern United States. It was a real pleasure to speak with Nick, and as well as the Chupacabra case, we cover Goatman cases, the infamous Slender Man, as well as his upcoming projects. His investigation into the Rendlesham Enigma, which has caused some ripples already in the world of ufology, to put it mildly, and a summer release covering monsters of lakes and seas, which I'm thoroughly looking forward to. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and I'm finally delighted to get Nick on the show. Other than that, I've been busy working on a couple of things behind the scenes, as well as finally launching some merchandise. So if you fancy grabbing yourself a Mysteries and Monsters mug, phone case, or some stickers, then you can check out our shop on Redbubble under Mysteries and Monsters. I'll put the links in the show notes too for you as well. As always, you can find us across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to our newly updated YouTube channel. And don't forget to keep spreading the word with a nice review on whichever podcast app you use. You can also donate money to the show via PayPal by searching for Mysteries and Monsters. And if you've got any feedback, guest suggestions, or if you just want to say hello, then email me at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. Once again, a big thanks to everybody who's got in touch recently. So hello and thank you to John, Rachel, Lisa, Sarah, Claire, Stephen and Andreas for getting in touch. Remember, take care, stay safe and keep looking out for everybody, all right? Now, let's join Nick Redfern to unravel the mystery of El Chupacabra. And much, much more. My guest today is simply a force of fortean nature with a work rate that puts us all to shame. Mr. Nick Redfern has been a trailblazing investigator and author since the mid-1990s. With countless television appearances, articles and books to his name, Nick is clearly one of the UK's best exports to America. Nick, I am delighted to finally welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we, sir?
Hey, Paul. I'm doing good, thanks. How's it going over there?
Oh, well, you know, we keep on keeping on, really, and, you know, I've had an exciting 30-minute walk this morning, so, yeah, it's all good.
I'm good.
How about yourself? How's your lockdown going?
Well, it's kind of about the same, really, you know, just making sure that, you stay safe and do what we got to do, you know, to hopefully get through all this and we can put it behind us one of the days.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. It's been quite tempting because the weather's been surprisingly pleasant for April in the UK recently. So I think we've got some rainy weather coming, so I think that might keep a few people inside a bit more next week. So, I mean, Nick, I'm not going to insult anybody, any of my listeners' intelligence. You are one of probably the most well-known fortean authors out there. You've continually shone a light on a variety of subjects, from ufology to the paranormal to strange cryptids around the world. You've continued to develop this, for the best part of 25 years, Nick. So was it just a situation that you drifted into? Because obviously you started out working. Was it a music magazine you originally started out on?
Well, yeah. When I finished school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. When I was at school, me and my mates were just, we were like a gang, and we just didn't want to go to school. We're just interested in not much at all at school, and I didn't go to college, no university, nothing at all, and just walked out of school when I was 16 with about 3 or 4 CSE grade 4s or something like that, the old CSEs. and then it was a case of, well, you know, you go from being in school to in the real world, so to speak. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And even though I wasn't that good at school, I did enjoy, reading and things like that. And so I thought, well, I wonder if there's any way I could get into that kind of world. And just as fate would have it, in the little town, not too far from where I lived at that time as a kid, they had an ad for somebody straight out of school, and it was a magazine called Zero, and it was basically like a local entertainment, what's on sort of magazine / newspaper kind of thing. And I went along and said, I was honest with them. I didn't really have much in the way of qualifications, but I enjoyed writing. You did a few stories as a kid. I'm sure that'd be embarrassingly awful now. But nevertheless, they said, we'll give you a try. And they taught me sort of all the background in journalism and how to structure a story and how to, bring the reader into the story, and to grab their attention, and how to do an interview and all this business. And I did that for a few years, and unfortunately the magazine closed down, and so I went from various jobs to warehouse work, van driver, forklift driver. That went on from sort of 21 to about 25, and I got to about 24, 25, and I thought, well, I could keep doing this, these jobs I don't really like much, or I could have a go at sort of getting more into writing. And I got enough in the bank to sort of last me for about 3 months, and I thought, well, I'm either gonna do something that I hate for the rest of my life, or I'm gonna try and do something that I really enjoy. And I developed an interest in sort of Fortiana, paranormal, UFOs, cryptozoology. And I put pitched a couple of ideas to Simon and Schuster in London, and I was amazed when they said, we'll give you a three book deal. And it really went from there, sort of 26, 27. And then I started doing sort of freelance, and then late sort of 90s, as you said in the intro. I started doing the book work, and that's sort of really how it all took off. But what it was that actually got me interested in all of this is that when I was about 5 or 6, my parents took me on a week's vacation to Scotland. Should call it a holiday. I called it a vacation.
Yes.
Yeah. 20 years in America, I tend not to use words like holidays.
That's all right.
But we went on holiday for a week, and to Scotland. And of course, if you're going to go to Scotland, you've got to go to Loch Ness. And my dad told me the story of the Loch Ness monster, or monsters, as we sort of sat in like deck chairs at Loch Ness, and that really got me excited. Even at that age, sort of 5 or 6, I understood what it all meant. There's monsters in the loch, that kind of thing. So I never really forgot that trip to Loch Ness. And then when I was about 10, 11, 12, I started reading books by people like Brad Steiger and Charles Blitz, like Bermuda Triangle and stuff like that. And that's sort of what really took it all off, I guess, sort of in many respects, kind of being in the right place at the right time after finishing school to allow me to sort of get into that world, you know. So.
Yeah, I mean, it did seem. I think it's one of those eras, Nick, because the mid 90s, it just seemed to be a massive explosion in Fortean culture, really. And I think that was. There were a few things going on, I think, especially here in the UK, because obviously the X-Files had exploded and that had kind of done really well on both sides of the Atlantic. And obviously something that I'm sure we both adore, which is the Fortean Time, seemed to just explode. I remember picking up my first copy from W.H. Smith's in, I don't know, 94, 95. And obviously... It just seemed to be so much seemed to be happening at that time, and there was programs like Sightings was on, and there was a few other shows that were sort of everywhere on the Sci-Fi Channel, and the explosion in satellite TV as well. So it just seemed a real cultural hotspot at that point for people like us who just loved weird things.
Well, you're right, and I think at one time there was like 8 magazines, if I remember right. There was Graham Birdsall's UFO magazine. There was Uri Geller's Encounters, there was Alien Encounters, Sightings, there was one UFO something or other, and then there was the X Factor.
Yes.
There was a bunch of them. Some of them didn't last very long at all. In fact, most of them didn't. But yeah, you're right. I mean, from sort of 93-ish when the X-Files took off, and then... That era when, you know, a lot of books were coming out and all those magazines, sort of 95 through about 99. And then it kind of dropped off, you know, I mean, to like a steady level rather than the crazy level, you know, of the 90s. But yeah, that was a sort of fun era, you know, and it was sort of almost unique, I guess, in ufology at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite funny. You mentioned X Factor there, because obviously most people these days will only know the TV show. But I was talking to somebody a few months ago on one of the Fortean Times message boards on Facebook, and they'd found a stash of old UFO magazines and said, "Oh, does anybody want them for postage and packaging?" So I said, "Yeah, I'll have them." And it had about 10 issues of the X Factor in it,
cool.
Which also included a wonderful VHS copy of the Roswell autopsy. Oh, so yeah, it was just like a little taking a step back in time to that crazy summer of 95. It was just very strange. And obviously, one of the key things that happened in 1995 and one of the subjects we're going to dive into is obviously 1995 saw the emergence of the cultural phenomenon that became El Chupacabra.
Yeah, you're right. And this year it sort of celebrates, if that's the right word, the 25th anniversary of the Chupacabra phenomenon actually beginning. And that's sort of one of my big interests. And although the phenomenon, you know, sort of began in the mid 1990s, you know, people like Graham Birdsall and various other people who were putting magazines out, like Sightings, things like that, you know, they were giving coverage to this subject. So I followed it quite deeply, you know, from round about 95, 96 till 2003. And then it kind of changed a bit because 2004, the next year, was when I went to Puerto Rico for the first time to do some investigations into the Chupacabra. And this was actually with a film crew, and it was the Sci-Fi Channel, and they were making a program, or a series I should say, called Proof Positive, and it was on different types of subjects, and one of them was a hunt for the Chupacabra. So they got me, and also John Downs, who runs the Centre for Fortean Zoology. I don't need to tell you about that, but there might be a few people. There might be just a few people who aren't aware of who John is, but most people are. And John's been a sort of a great friend of mine. We've known each other since about 1996, 1997, something like that. And I remember the first time I spoke to John, it was on the phone one night when he'd... he'd done a review of my first book, A Covert Agenda, and that's how we became friends. And then I think the next time I had contact with him, we were both at a conference together in somewhere down in Kent, and we both got absolutely smashed together. But it sort of created a good friendship, you know, which is still there. And and so when the team from the Sci-Fi Channel said, well, you know, we want like a not so much a team, but we want like a couple of people to go out. And I said, well, I said to them, they suggest, you know, you get John, because John had actually gone out with a Channel 4 show back in, I think it was 1999, and he'd gone from Puerto Rico to Mexico, and then I think back to Puerto Rico. Mm. And because he'd been there before, and I'd sort of followed the story, they were, you know, pleased to get us on board. And we went for about 8 or 9 days, just sort of, you know, going all around Puerto Rico, speaking to ranchers, farmers, veterinarians, police officers, civil defense people who'd either seen these creatures or with the civil defense people, they were actually putting files together, you know, and demonstrating how, you know, they got dossiers for the Puerto Rican government. And we had a good sort of wide range of accounts and witnesses. Some of them described seeing this kind of about a chimpanzee type creature in terms of size, but without any hair, but having these sort of spikes down its head and down through the back of its neck and head and back. And some of them described seeing these bat-like wings and these glowing red eyes. So it was a very weird-looking animal. But the thing that really got the attention of people on Puerto Rico was that, in many respects, it was related to the claims that whatever these creatures were, that they were draining farm animals of blood. So you had this sort of vampire-type aspect come into it. And that's when it really took off. And so we delved into all of that for the show, and then in the following year I did another show in the following year, and it was called The Island of Blood, and kind of an interesting name, and that was for Red Star Films in Canada. And again, that was about a 7, 8, 9 day trek around, and got more and more data. And since then, I've been to Puerto Rico on many occasions, the last time just a few years ago. And I put all the data that I'd got together in a book called Chupacabra Road Trip, which was sort of, as the title kind of suggests, it was like a road trip type trek around, not just Puerto Rico, but also around the United States and parts of Brazil and Central America, where there'd been other reports of creatures that people were saying, oh, well, that's the chupacabra. And certainly the most well-known kind of spin-off from the original chupacabra would have been the Texas reports, and it became known as the Texas chupacabra, but it was very different to the one that was seen on Puerto Rico. The so-called Texas chupacabra is very much like, it is a hairless canid, you know, a canine animal. But, you know, the skeptics have said, well, they're just coyotes with mange, you know. But they're actually not, you know, it's not mange. They're actually developing in a completely hairless fashion. And they have these shorter front limbs, which gives them this weird kind of hopping kangaroo-type movement. And a good friend of mine, Ken Gerhardt, Ken thinks that, and he probably is right with his theory, he thinks that the Texas ones are actually mutated coyotes. By mutated, I mean at like a DNA level. And he's done a lot of research into what are called mutagens, like sulfur dioxide, which is one of the big pollutants in Texas, can actually affect like, a pregnant woman or a pregnant animal. And these mutagens can actually alter at a DNA level animals. And Ken's found that in areas of Texas where there are clusters of the so-called Texas chupacabra, there are sulfur dioxide plants, if you like, you know. So I think Ken's onto something with that. And So we've got two creatures that have become known as the chupacabra, but they're actually very different to each other. So but it makes it kind of complex, but it makes it intriguing as well, you know, and sometimes puzzling, because people say, you know, well, that's not the chupacabra, it looks like a dog. And then somebody else says, well, no, it's bipedal and it's got these spikes down its head and neck. So then you sort of have to explain, no, there's actually two different phenomena, but with the same name. And that's kind of unique, almost. You don't really find two or three unknown animals all given the same name, but all of them being completely different to each other as well.
Yeah, it is perplexing. I've never really, you know, to my shame, Nick, I've never really understood why the Texas Blue Dogs, as some other people call them, ended up. I know, obviously, there's that famous footage. I think it's two police officers driving down the road who see this strange animal, as you say, sort of bounding as it's running down the road. And obviously, when it turns, you see that elongated snout of it. And I think the female officer goes, oh, it's the chupacabra. And I'm thinking, but it doesn't look anything like what the chupacabra is supposed to be. And so it is very odd, as you say there, that we've got two very distinctly different creatures, at least, that both get called the same names, but seem to be completely different.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, explain why both of them became known as the chupacabra. Well, the one in Puerto Rico, obviously, that was called the chupacabra because that was the first, you know, the first phenomenon that was reported in 1995. And chupacabra is actually sort of Latin American for goat sucker. And a lot of the animals that originally attacked were goats. And ranchers said that, you know, the blood had been drained from them, et cetera, et cetera. But what the reason why people started to talk about the Texas chupacabra is particularly down by Austin and San Antonio is where the original reports of these blue dogs, you know, these hairless dogs. And one of the ranchers said that they noticed when they saw this weird animal that was sort of preying on a farm animal, that it was lapping the blood from the animal. Now, nobody actually said that it was sucking the blood in relation to these Texas stories, but they did say that they saw these animals lapping the blood from the open wounds. And then, you know, then people in and around Austin and San Antonio started to say, well, hang on, that sounds like that monster on Puerto Rico that drinks like blood as well. And that's actually how it all began, because that's the only reason why the two were given the same name, because there was this blood angle in relation to both of the creatures.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously the key aspect of the Texas case is obviously we have the Phyllis Canyon situation as well, which is, and I've always found that very odd, because being obsessed with cryptozoology and monsters, Nick, I've watched every show that's probably been shown in the last 20 years. And I remember seeing Phyllis Canyon on Monster Quest at the end of the noughties. And they ended up doing a DNA test when she'd had it, because she had it stuffed and mounted, didn't she? And it's a strange-looking creature at the best of times. And you can, you know, especially the striking blue eyes and the skin. And the strangest thing about that is, I think last year I saw a documentary, and it was almost as if she'd completely changed her situation, and she was saying, it's unknown, nobody can tell me what it is. And I was thinking, well, 10 years ago, you were told it was a hybrid. What's your take on that, Nick? Do you think that story has undergone a change from the original report and the DNA? Because I think there were five universities did tests on the corpse, and they all kind of came back saying it was a coyote wolf hybrid mixed type thing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most of them are actually where DNA has been collected, and in relation to, you know, most cryptids, you know, we don't have the solid evidence, but we do with these animals in Texas. And the basic situation is that most of those that have been analyzed for DNA, it has come back as coyote DNA. That is a fact. But as I said, there are these alterations with the small limbs, so they have this weird hopping, They have this on the jaws, for example, the top jaw. It's like a huge overbite sometimes, which it should be. It should be sort of level, you know, with the lower jaw to help. You know, that's how animals, even like us, you know, we eat. But with these animals, they have this huge overbite. A lot of them have this humped kind of spine and these weird pouches on their back legs, which no one could really figure out what they were. And they're actually present on that that stuffed animal. But there are a number of cases where the DNA was shown to be crossed with wild wolf, with Mexican wolves, and with dogs as well, regular dogs. So, you know, in some respects, we are seeing similarities in the sense that they are all canids. They're all canine animals. And it does allow, you know, the DNA of all of those does allow them to sort of crossbreed. So, you know, when you put together the angle of mutagens and how that's changed them, and then there's this sort of DNA of various other animals within the canine group, then you can really understand how the development of some strange-looking ones, but still looking like, you know, canine animals, you can see how some of these animals did begin to look odd because, you know, there was a mixture of DNA. It wasn't just necessarily one thing or the other.
Yeah. And in regards to the Texas situation, Nick, because I think one of the key aspects of the Central American and, you know, Puerto Rico and places like that, there seem in it, it's a real mixture of superstition and conspiracy, as well as a supernatural aspect to it. Whereas, is there that kind of backstory to the Texas situation, or are people just accepting that this is a, you know, it's through the mutagens in the environment and crossbreeding, whereas the other chupacabra, people suspect that it's all down to, you know, dodgy scientific experiments in the middle of a rainforest?
Well, yeah, that's a good point because, again, that shows the differences rather than the parallels between the two. For example, most people in Texas, but it's not just, it's called the Texas Chupacabra, but I mean, they've now been seen in surrounding states like Oklahoma, New Mexico, Louisiana, and further as well. So it's not, you know, we call it the Texas Chupacabra, but that's, you know, what its original title was. However, most people, if not everybody, you know, talked about it just being a weird animal. There weren't really any sort of conspiratorial aspects to the story in the U.S. But in Puerto Rico, that angle of conspiracy was sort of dominating all over Puerto Rico, but in very different ways. For example, you had the theory that these creatures were animals from another world, you know, extraterrestrial animals. And people were sort of paralleling this to kind of like the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Predator, you know, that it was, that these creatures were like on safari almost, you know, they'd come here and they were feeding on, you know, in the El Yunque rainforest, and which is not unlike how, you know, the terrain looks like in Predator, you know, it's almost identical. And so you had the extraterrestrial alien angle as sort of hunters, if you like. But then there are other theories that, which I'd never been able to resolve this, but it's like kind of, you know, rumor mills and friend of a friend stories. But just off the coast of Puerto Rico, there's a small island which for many years has done research into rhesus monkeys. And the research itself, a lot of it is focused on SIV, which is the simian version of HIV in people. And so, you know, they do a lot of good work there, you know, in terms of ways and means to try and fully not just, you know, slow the advance of HIV, but also to, you know, they're trying to find ways to actually completely wipe it out as a disease at all. So But and that is, you know, a genuine lab, if you like, that it does work off the coast of Puerto Rico. But there are rumours that some of the rhesus monkeys that we use there escaped and somehow got onto the mainland of Puerto Rico. And the theory is that on some occasions people may have seen, you know, rhesus monkeys running around at high speed, perhaps, you know, late at night, don't get a full look at them, but you just see this sort of strange little creature, well, not so much little, they're actually quite big, but, you know, running around the terrain of Puerto Rico. And some people have suggested that genuine sort of mistaken identity could be at the heart of some of these cases in relation to rhesus monkeys. And then the other theory, which is quite popular, is the idea that the chupacabras on Puerto Rico are sort of quite literally supernatural, you know, occult, as if in the sense they've been sort of manifested and called forth using sort of rituals and rites, that kind of thing. And Puerto Rico does have a lot of, you know, sort of that kind of thing on Puerto Rico, like Santeria and voodoo and things like that. And that has, in many respects, has provoked a lot of people on the island to think the creatures are, you know, something, as I said, like occult-based or supernatural. So so there are a lot of theories, and it's interesting that there's a lot of theories, but sometimes it can be a little bit sort of tiring because there are so many theories, you know, to follow rather than just one.
Yeah, it is unusual because, like I say, as you touch on there, there are people who claim that they're aliens. There are people that say that they're supernatural. We've got the crazed scientific experiments going on. We've got genetically mutated monkey stories. It's, as cryptids go, I think it's one of those that it's a real mishmash of potential theories of why it turned up when it did.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's interesting is the same time frame when the whole phenomenon kicked off in the 90s, it is interesting that from around about 1989-90 through the early 2000s, there was actually quite a lot of UFO activity on Puerto Rico. And a lot of the people I interviewed, specifically on the UFO angle, described seeing like these large black flying triangle types that have been seen quite often in the UK and the US. So, you know, it kind of sowed the seeds for the Chupacabra when you had, you know, these pre-existing UFO activity on the island as well. But you're right, there is like this entire really weird combination of all these things all sort of meshed into one. And, you know, the interesting thing is you don't really find that with other cryptids. You know, Bigfoot's Bigfoot, you know, Nessie's Nessie, but the Chupacabra is a monkey versus an occult thing versus, you know, sort of an altered rhesus monkey. Yeah, you know, the list goes on, and that's one of the things that sort of fascinates me is as a researcher and an investigator and a writer, you know, there's so many aspects to this story, and there's some down-to-earth but also intriguing theories, and I'd never actually thought of this one particular theory until it was brought to my attention, because I didn't realise what was going on the island. But one of the people I interviewed was a police officer, and he told me, how, nothing to do with the Chupacabra directly, but he said that he was involved in the investigation in the mid-2000s, sort of 2004, 2005, where there were people who'd smuggled onto Puerto Rico like exotic large cats, and that some of them supposedly had escaped. Now, you know, you could say this is kind of like folklore in making, because it sounds very much like the ABCs, you know, the alien big cats in the UK. People say, oh, well, you know, they escaped from this zoo or from this enclosure. You know, everybody knows those stories. And they're just like that on Puerto Rico. You know, somebody had a black panther and it escaped. I mean, it is interesting that, you know, the idea that sort of large predatory exotic cats were brought to Puerto Rico and did escape, maybe in some of the cases at least, you know, not necessarily by looking at them. You're not going to mistake a chupacabra for a large cat. But if the animals were found dead, you know, that I could understand how they might be attributed to the chupacabra if nobody actually saw the creature, but they actually saw, you know, the dead animal killed by the cat. So, you know, I do wonder if, you know, it could actually be not just one thing. You know, two or three theories could be correct. You know, some could be a genuine unknown chupacabra. Others could be a genuine alien big cat, you know. So there's a lot of puzzles that still exist, you know, and I doubt we'll ever really get sort of the full story of the chupacabra and, you know, what it actually is or was and how it ties in with the occult and UFOs. I mean, it can't really tie into every one of them. Yeah. But again, that's sort of one of the weird challenges is to try and figure out why there are so many theories and how many of them are valid, you know.
Yeah, I mean, during your research on Puerto Rico, because, you know, as we mentioned there, 1995, when I think it was Madeline Talentos was the first real witness who came forward and said that she'd witnessed it. And I know it ended up being dismissed that she'd basically hallucinated seeing a monster that had, because obviously the key connection certain people have made is that she was basically seeing the creature from the film Species.
Yeah, well, the problem I have with that, and I pointed out this, I was going to write an article about this, what I'm going to say now, but, and I may well do it now, but what I did after, when people were talking about Species, the movie, and the Chupacabra, etc., you know, you can go through the history of movie making throughout, not just the US, you know, not just Hollywood, but the UK and elsewhere. You can find parallels between monster movies and real creatures, etc., which parallel, you know, in terms of time frames. I mean, like the Hammer movie with Peter Cushing, The Abominable Snowman.
Yes.
Well, you know, that was a popular movie when it came out in the late 50s, and people were seeing Yetis in the late 50s, you know. Mm-hmm. And so basically what I'm saying is that just because a movie comes out and somebody sees a monster, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a connection. You know, horror movies are being put out all the time, and cryptids are being seen all the time. So chances are, at some point, you're going to get crossovers between the two, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one of, I think that's one of my favourite Hammer films. I think it's underrated. It's a fantastic film. It's a very, it's one of those lost classics that I don't think's shown enough at all, The Abominable Snowman.
Well, that is a good one. I'll tell you why I enjoy it, because it's not like you... I mean, I love all those Hammer movies, but what I enjoy about that, and which is intriguing as well, it's not like your typical blood and guts type movie, you know. It's, you know, the so-called monsters are actually presented as sort of, you know, far more advanced in sort of a spiritual way than we are. And, you know, the way they look when you get to see them finally, they don't look like, you know, some sort of savage, you know, King Kong type thing, you know. They look very wise and, you know, almost eerie, you know. Mm. And so, yeah, that's a really cool movie that, yeah, it has its sort of moments of death and, you know, killings and whatever. But for the most part, it is more... It's almost like a mind-body-spirit type movie in many respects.
Mm. Yeah, it is. And it's one of those where, you know, the Abominable Snowmen are minding their own business and this team turns up, kills one, and therefore they actually want to revenge this member of their community that's been killed by these annoying humans.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it sort of it makes you think on a lot of levels, you know, about... our sort of destructive ways, you know, whether deliberate or accidental, we screw things up all the time, you know. And I think what that showed was that the Abominable Snowman, the Yeti in the movies, you know, the theory is that they were just waiting for us to destroy ourselves and then they could, you know, sort of live in peace and whatever. So.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem to be one of those go-to sceptical explanations, and I've seen it, and I'm sure you've come across this hundreds of times, Nick, especially, you know, like in the 1950s, the boom of UFO sightings. I've seen people dismiss things like Hopkinsville and things like that as saying that people had simply been to the cinema and had overactive imaginations. And I'm thinking that works on the print, but that always frustrates me because that works on the principle that in those days nobody had anything better to do than go to the local drive-in.
Yeah, that's a good point. But I think, you know, it does really come back to, you know, that angle of sci-fi movies, horror movies, supernatural movies are extremely popular and have been, you know, since movies are around, even when there were silent movies, you know. Mm-hmm. But also, you've got genuine paranormal stuff going on at the same time. So I think, you know, to say that, you know, a UFO movie comes out and then somebody 6 weeks later sees a UFO, for me, that doesn't really prove anything because, you know, there's so much of this all going on at the same time anyway. So, I mean, you could, the whole thing with, Puerto Rico and the Chupacabra and the ties with species, well, you could actually make a case that, you know, kind of similar to what I mentioned earlier with the parallels between the Chupacabra and the Predator movie. I mean, if you watch that movie, you've got this sort of fast-moving alien that, you know, in a huge rainforest. Well, that's exactly what you've got in Puerto Rico. You know, you've got this fast-running, violent creature running around a rainforest. So why didn't anybody bring up, in relation to Predator? Why bring it up in relation to species? So, you know, you can find, basically what I'm saying is, you can find the answers you want to because there are so many movies and there are so many genuine reports, you know. So it's no wonder that people occasionally, you know, the two cross over.
Yeah. I mean, when you started digging into it, Nick, was it one of those cases where 1995 was probably when it actually made the mainstream media, but when you started to look at it, there were actually cases that predated this this fanfare over the summer of 95.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. The reason being that it's something that revolves all around a creature known as the Mocha vampire. And now, Mocha is an area on the island of Puerto Rico. And back in the 1970s, specifically 1975, there was a rash of encounters and sightings and killings of farm animals in and around Mocha. As I said, this was 1975. Mm. And ranchers whose animals were killed said that their animals were drained of blood, and it became known quite obviously as the Mocha vampire. Now, the term Chupacabra didn't exist in the slightest in 1975. It would be another 20 years before that would happen. But this sort of brief series of attacks, which was round about 2 months and then it was over, people were talking about this creature, and it was vaguely humanoid, had these large wings, which some of the reports of the Chupacabra talk about large wings as well, but more sort of bat-like. And it went on, you know, sort of one of these sort of classic waves, you know, that you get throughout the world of the paranormal and Fortiana, where there's like a wave and then it's gone, that kind of thing. So we can make a good case that the Chupacabra that began in the 1990s and the Mocha vampire that began, the phenomenon began in 1975, you can actually make a good case that they were one and the same. But one became known as the Mocha vampire. 20 years later, one became known as the Chupacabra. And so there's this tendency, and I know this from speaking to people, there's a tendency for a lot of people there to think it's two different animals. But I think, you know, you could make a good argument that it was actually one and the same, really.
I mean, the other aspect of this is, obviously, I know we've mentioned this a couple of times, is obviously the majority of animals that were found, the perception is that there's no blood anywhere. And whenever I think of that, I'm no forensic expert, Nick, but I know about lividity. So when yes. something dies, the blood usually, other than, you know, if there's a wound, there'll obviously be a bit of a spillage. But normally, any creature that dies, the blood sinks to the bottom. So
that's right.
In regards to doing the autopsies, was that, you know, obviously this drained of blood, there's no blood anywhere. Mm-hmm. Was that something that they just didn't comprehend, and it was only when autopsies started doing that, you know, they were doing the necropsies and looking at this and finding the lividity?
Well, yeah, this is one of the most important parts of the story because it relates to this whole issue of blood. Mm. Now, one of the things I found, and this makes a lot of sense, but a lot of people don't necessarily think about it, is that a lot of ranchers, when their animals have been killed, you know, and they claim that, you know, killed by the chupacabra and drained of blood and all that business, what I found out was that the veterinarians would only do like a necropsy, an autopsy, of the farm animals if they were prepared to pay the veterinarians to do that. Now, unfortunately, on Puerto Rico, you know, there's a lot of poverty. You know, I've been there many times, you know, got made some really nice friends out there. Mm. And, you know, the people are really cool people. The downside is that much of Puerto Rico is very poor. And I learned very quickly that many of the farmers just didn't have the money to, you know, to organize a necropsy to see what had happened. And so, you know, their animals were dead. You know, that was their sort of livelihood. And so they weren't overly, well, I mean, they wanted answers, but they couldn't afford to, you know, to sort of go to a lab and have it sort of autopsied or necropsied, you know. Mm. And so the stories very much became legends. But what I did find out was that, you know, people had been telling me, oh, you know, this chicken or this goat or this pig have been drained of blood. And when I would go to the places, and this was the same with John and when I went with the Red Star Films in 2005 and the other cases, mm. what we found time and again was that ranchers said, well, you know, when we opened them up, we couldn't see any blood. And you're right, when an animal dies or a person dies, the blood sinks to the lower part of the body. So if you open up the top part of the body, which is the highest, you won't see much blood because it sinks to the lower levels. But as I said, most of the ranchers there, they didn't want to lose even more money by having to hire a veterinarian or whatever. So what I found was that there really wasn't much research done in terms of trying to figure out exactly how much blood had been removed or how much blood had sunk. So what I think is that whatever these creatures are, maybe they have sort of something for blood and they lap the blood in the same way, possibly like vampire bats do. You know, vampire bats, contrary to what people think, don't suck blood at all. They make like an incision into the skin and they lap it, like your pet dog would lap up water or milk. You know, that's exactly what they do. So I think there's a possibility that that has happened, but I have to say, after all the years, I haven't come across a credible case of literal blood sucking by these creatures. And again, you know, that's not the fault at all of the people on Puerto Rico. You know, it's kind of, if you look at it from our perspective, you know, you're on a limited budget anyway, you want an answer, but you've got to go and pay X number of dollars, you know, to get the animal studied. And, you know, they're on a limited budget to start with. So that's why I think there's been so little examination in this fashion, but a hell of a lot of rumour mill, you know.
Absolutely. Is it also one of those things, as we've touched on there, things seem to become fashionable for a bit. And obviously the chupacabra was high fashion for a couple of years. And then it, like, you know, as you said, it kind of dropped out at the end of the 90s. And then obviously we had the Texas situation pop up. In Central America and Puerto Rico and areas around there, has it continued and it's just not got attention, Nick, because people have got bored of it in the mainstream?
I don't know if it's so much boredom, but what I have found, I mean, the last time I went to Puerto Rico was 2016, and what I found is that the attacks are still going on there. Farmers, ranchers, they're still finding their animals dead, and, you know, with no proof or understanding as to who's doing this or what's doing it. But what I've also found is that for the most part, the ranchers just don't bother reporting it, you know, to veterinarians, to police officers, to UFO investigators, for monster hunters. They just don't, you know, it's a hassle to them because they're losing money. But they just don't want, you know, a bunch of guys tramping around their properties, you know, and demanding to be told this story of what happened. You know, they just don't want to know. But what I find, you know, so you would think if you didn't actually go to, say, Puerto Rico up until 2016, 2017, you really would think the whole thing's died away. But people think that because nobody's really going out there still and investigating these cases, and even the ranchers themselves just don't, as I said, they just don't want the hassle, you know, and they just don't want to have people, you know, going around their fields and taking pictures. So a lot of it is, everything's kind of just sort of stayed, you know, kind of what stays on the island stays on the island, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's a lot of it as well. People think because there's no reports, it's died off. It's not. People at ranches are just fed up of people visiting them when they hear of a story or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you touched on, this year's the 25th anniversary, and you've released an updated version of your Chupacabra road trip, I believe, Nick.
Yeah, the book originally came out in 2016 through Llewellyn Books, and it sold quite well. For the first 2016 to 18, and then the publisher Llewellyn said, "Well, you know, we've done well with it, but would you like the rights back to it?" And which isn't a bad thing, you know. So I spoke to my agent Lisa, and she said, "Well, yeah, we could put out. You know, Llewellyn don't want to keep putting it out." And so what we decided to do was to revamp the original one and give it a new cool cover, and but not just do that, more importantly, add all the new material that had come out between 2016 and 2019 when the new version came out. So you can actually see some of the original ones still available on Amazon. If you type in Amazon Chupacabra road trip, you'll see two different covers. One of them shows like a desert location with this winged creature crossing the road, and the other one shows something which is kind of a cross between the Puerto Rico one and the Texas one, and that's got sort of a grey and red cover, and that's the brand new one, and it's got a lot more artwork and photographs as well that bring things, as I said, right up to you know, the as far as I could get it, you know, sort of 2019. But I still get asked about it, and I still get, you know, people contact me about their sightings, particularly the Texas ones and Oklahoma. And, you know, the phenomenon's still, you know, alive and living. So.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things, Nick. If you look for it, you'll realise it's still there.
Yes, and if you don't, and very often, if people don't hear of it, you know, it's all dropped off, people think it's gone. Well, now it's just that, as I said, ranchers don't want to know. They're kind of done with it. There aren't that many people on the island anymore doing that kind of active research anyway. Now, it really has kind of dropped off. And of course, there's the issue of just the monetary logistics of getting out there. I mean, I've been very lucky because nearly all of the expeditions I've done on Puerto Rico have been undertaken at the cost of TV companies, which, from my perspective, is really good, you know, because they're willing to pay. But I mean, I couldn't sort of, you know, afford to back and forth to Puerto Rico twice a year, you know. So that's an important thing to remember as well. You know, most people in the cryptozoological field, you know, we're all self-funded, and when you're self-funded, I mean, sometimes that sort of reflects on, if you got money, that's great. If you haven't, well, it's not so great, you know, in terms of getting out there for 10 days or whatever, you know, hiring a Jeep and 10 days in a hotel and all this and that. You know, it soon mounts up. So that's one of the reasons why I think you don't find too much research done from outside Puerto Rico and people coming into Puerto Rico, because of finances. It really is, I think, as simple as that in many respects.
Yeah. Well, I think probably it's a good idea to kind of bring a cryptid that's a little bit more on your doorstep, Nick, which is, I've always found these stories, is the Goat Man. Now,
oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm aware, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I probably will be, Nick, I'm aware that there are three legendary goat men stories that seem to be based in America. I think there's one in Texas, one in Kentucky, and is there one in Maryland as well?
Well, there are, but there's some lesser-known ones as well, where people claim to have seen sort of like horned, hairy humanoid things. Not many, but you're right. The ones you just mentioned are the primary ones. And where I live about a 20-minute drive from Dallas, Texas. Mm. A lot of people think, and I actually thought when I came to the U.S., I thought, you know, Texas, when I was going to move here, was all going to be like desert and cactus, you know, and horses and cowboys and all that kind of thing. It's actually not. I mean, West Texas is very flat, like cotton fields, and South Texas is very much like desert, you know, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. However, East Texas, as I said, I live just outside Dallas. If I get outside of the east side of Dallas, and you just keep driving, then leads you towards the border with Louisiana. Well, probably 20 minutes outside, 25 minutes outside of East Dallas, you're in like Epping Forest or something like that.
Yeah,
East Texas is just massive amounts of forest. People think, you know, like I said, it's desert. It isn't. Yeah. It's and that's why, you know, a lot of people, they kind of laugh when you say, you know, there's a lot of reports of Bigfoot in Texas. Yeah. You know, people say, well, can't you just see it because there's just desert everywhere? You know,
yes.
But actually, there isn't desert everywhere. That's actually more like New Mexico and Arizona. But East Texas, heavily forested, that's where we get reports of Bigfoot-type creatures, and we get Goatman reports as well. Now, the two primary ones, one of them from 1969, occurred at a place called Lake Worth in Texas. And it's kind of confusing because Lake Worth is the name of the town, and Lake Worth is the name of the lake at Lake Worth as well. So so it's like if you roll into town, you say, you know, is this Lake Worth? I said, well, are you looking for Lake Worth the town or Lake Worth the lake? But in 1969, there were reports of this weird creature that was humanoid and seen late at night bounding across the roads and through the woods of Lake Worth. And Lake Worth, again, is heavily, massively forested, wooded. And people were describing it as sort of almost like a primitive human-type creature, but with these horns coming out of its head. And that's why it became known as the Goat Man. Some people claim to see that it had, like, hoofed feet and claws, and supposedly it jumped onto somebody's car and scratched all the windows and the doors and threw this old car tire at somebody or a group of people that were trying to pursue it. And for about 3 or 4 weeks, maybe a bit longer, there was really kind of like Goatman mania. And you can go back and, you know, go to the local library and read all the old newspapers. And today, the lake is as it's always been, and, you know, the forested, wooded area is still the same. But the people, you know, who run it and look after it, the wildlife people, they put on a yearly conference, the Goatman Festival. And they've sort of embraced the whole thing, and, you know, they have bands playing out there and singing songs about the Goatman, and, you know, the press come along and they have, you know, sort of, you know, pin the needle on the Goatman, that kind of thing, you know. And so people have made it sort of, you know, a fun event for the family. But it doesn't take away the fact that, you know, for this brief period in 69, people were seeing this really strange creature. And now, north of here, about an hour north of Dallas, there's a place called Denton, which is an old town. And it has one of these old sort of 19th century railway tracks. And it's sort of, it's kind of creepy and weird looking. It's sort of like isolated and rusted, and it goes back around about 100 years. And people have talked about seeing one of these goatman type creatures lurking around the bridge as well. And as I'm sure you know, throughout the world of the paranormal, you can find stories all over the place of sort of haunted bridges, you know. There's the ghost of the old lady lurks at the bridge, you know, or the or the creature that lives under the bridge. You know, for some reason, bridges seem to attract, you know, paranormal phenomena. And, and it's no different with the goat man in question, you know, in that particular case. So, and Denton, you know, you can go to there and see the bridge itself. And people often, particularly kids, you know, they go out there and sort of sit around and you know, hoping that the goat man's going to turn up. And there's also a third story, which was uncovered by a guy named Rob Riggs. Rob was a good guy. He did a lot of really good Bigfoot research investigations in Texas, but unfortunately he died a few years ago. But Rob uncovered just a solitary one story of somebody who claimed to have seen one of these goat man people at a place in Dallas, in one of the local lakes there, and had seen this creature sort of bounding across the area. And we're talking about literally like quarter of a mile from downtown Dallas. Dallas itself has a lot of lakes surrounding it, but this one was sort of literally described as, you know, sort of a three-minute drive from where President Kennedy was shot, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you, those are the sort of the three primary ones, you know, that we've got in Texas. There's the White Rock Lake case. That's the one that Rob Riggs looked into. Yeah. And we've got the Lake Worth one. And then we've got the Denton one as well, which are all pretty much within an hour's drive of each other. And it's become sort of like, you know, part of Texas culture and folklore. And a lot of reports, particularly from the 60s, you know, the 1969 one actually provoked a massive wave of reports coming in. So I think there genuinely was something. But, you know, some people have suggested, you know, could it be like a migrating Bigfoot, you know, with all the wooded areas, which is kind of an interesting theory, you know, that it was something that wasn't actually a goat man after all, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, especially the parallels with Denton, Nick, because obviously the other famous goat man is the Pope Lick monster in Kentucky, which
That's
is also allegedly hangs around a rail bridge. And unfortunately, this one is probably the most notorious because people have died trying to look for it. Because as far as I remember, there's a film, I think, made in the 80s called The Pope Lick Monster. And it gave the impression that this bridge, I think it's the Pope Lick Trestle, is abandoned. So kids turn up looking for the goat man, unaware that they are on a bridge. That it's a major freight route.
That's right, yeah, and you're right what you said, but there are actually, in this case, people who have died on that bridge, you know, while they're looking for this creature, and that actually sort of places it into sort of a, you know, an even more controversial category when you actually do have genuine deaths, you know, in relation to these situations. And But yeah, I mean, there's so many of these stories. I mean, you look at like the Mothman story in Point Pleasant. Well, the whole, you know, the thrust of the story, the pinnacle of it, was the collapse of the Silver Bridge, which collapsed into the Ohio River, killing literally dozens of people. And I mean, not too far where I grew up in the UK as a kid, just north of the Cannock Chase in Staffordshire, which has its own various weird activity going on. But just go a bit further, and you come to a little village called Ranton. And Ranton was the, or actually the Bridge 39 on the Shropshire Union Canal was the sighting in 1879 of a sort of like a spectral ape that bounded across the canal and has been seen on many occasions since. And it's clearly not a real, you know, monkey or chimpanzee or a gorilla. It's some sort of spectral supernatural thing. But the important thing is, you know, it was seen and still is seen at Bridge 39 on the older rail bridge, the canal bridge. And so all of these stories in many respects have similarities. You know, these creatures kind of bound out and terrify people, and then they bound away into the darkness. You know, that that is one of sort of the classic traits throughout all of these. It's almost as if they deliberately just terrify people for the sake of it, you know.
It seems that these particular cryptids seem to enjoy terrifying people and love to sort of scare the pants off people.
Well, you know, there's an interesting theory for this, and you actually I focused on this in a book I wrote a couple of years ago called Paranormal Parasites, and it looked at the idea that, you know, could some of these creatures, not all of them obviously, but some of them, could they be sort of like energy collecting or energy draining creatures that, you know, so they're what's the best way to sort of, you know, bleed somebody dry of a huge amount of energy is to put them in a state of, you know, of terror. So I sometimes wonder if there could be something to that theory, the idea that they're almost like, you know, they feed on energy, whereas we feed on food. Well, what's the best way to amplify levels of energy to, you know, create massive amounts of adrenaline and fear chemicals, that kind of thing, and then they bleed on that, and they essentially, you know, kind of like going to the gas station and filling up, you know.
Well, yeah, and I suppose if the perception of people, if you're going to these locations, Nick, you're kind of already on edge, because you're somewhere where these reports have come, and you're a bit, you're full of trepidation, and there's a little bit of excitement mixed with a little bit of fear, and you know, your brain's trying to rationalise it, saying, well, this is impossible, and then your emotions are heightened, aren't they, and therefore you may suspect something's happened, which, you know, on reflection you may be able to find a rational explanation for, but sometimes people just seem to have an experience that baffles them and terrifies them at the same time.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think there's another angle to all this. The, like you brought up, you know, the expectation of going out there and people know of the story and things like that. That kind of ties in with another big interest of mine, which is like the issue known as tulpas or thought forms, which began really, or the concept in terms of the names began, like, for example, with the Tibetan lore and legends, and the theory that if you think, you know, if enough people think about something and focus on it, whether deliberately or non-deliberately or consciously or unconsciously, they think about this and they think about that, and there are hundreds or thousands of people thinking of them and focusing on them, maybe even obsessing on them, and the theory is that the collective mindset of multiple numbers of people can spontaneously and briefly project into the real world something created out of the mind, or envisaged in the mind and then projected outward, and then it briefly has its own independent existence. I mean, a classic example, back in 2017, I wrote a book called The Slender Man Mysteries, which was a study of the whole phenomenon of the Slender Man, which began as like an internet meme. And then, you know, you had this sort of terrible attack of two girls in Wisconsin by one of their former friends. And, you know, that was sort of like went from just internet entertainment, you know, to attempted murder. You know, it was unforeseen. But what's intriguing is that in the wake of all the stories that were going online, I mean, for people who don't know, you know, the Slender Man was this character created by the internet by a guy named Eric Knudsen. And he basically came up with the image and the name, put these various artwork together and put it on the net. And people into the paranormal loved it. And people started to put their own little stories on the internet and their own artwork and, you know, creating photographs. Not to hoax anything, but just entertainment, you know, things like that. And it really started to get a big following. There was a show on YouTube that ran for a long time called Marble Hornets, which was like a YouTube multiple episode adventure story about the Slender Man. And so there was a period from round about 2010, 2012, 13, when the Slender Man phenomenon was literally being followed by thousands and thousands, predominantly kids. And then suddenly people started to claim they were seeing the Slender Man in the real world, you know, in the woods, in the forests, by the bridges. They'd wake up in the middle of the night with like sleep paralysis, and they would see the Slender Man, this sort of skinny black guy in a skinny black suit, this guy with this completely faceless face, you know, there was just no eyes, no nose, no mouth. That's how it looked. And people were seeing exactly what Eric Knudsen saw, but they were seeing it in the real world. So again, you've got the theory that yes, it was created by Eric Knudsen as entertainment, but it obsessed, and I do mean obsessed, so many people to the point where one, you know, they decided they had to kill one of their friends, you know, to appease the Slender Man. That's the point it got to. So, you know, the idea that the Slender Man has become a tulpa, a thought form, is intriguing to demonstrate how the human mind, you know, maybe some of our monsters at least are actually created by us, but unknowingly, you know, that we are actually responsible for what we see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember you, I think you were on Jim Harold when the book had come out, Nick, and I remember you telling the story. Was it an air hostess that had got in touch with you who was having some absolutely terrifying sightings of this creature in her house?
Yeah, this was a really weird story, and this kind of gets to the heart of this as well, you know, of the Slender Man coming to life. Her name was Lacey. Well, it still is. she told me how she got into the whole Slender Man thing, and that included, you know, reading all the books that were out there, which wasn't many at that time, but there were some. And she'd got all the available Kindle and online stories that people had put together. She did a lot of research, and this went on and on. And she, by her own admission, she did say that she got, you know, quite obsessed with this whole thing. And then she said on one occasion late at night, she was sat in front of her laptop, and then suddenly she said it was kind of like, well, you know, you blink and you miss it kind of things. It wasn't barely like 1 or 2 seconds, you know, it was kind of just at the corner of your eyes sort of thing. She saw like the head and the face of this, of the faceless Slender Man staring out of her laptop. And and this went on for 2 or 3 occasions, and I think the one time there was where it said something, I'm paraphrasing it, I forget the exact words, but it was something like, I can see you all the time, that kind of thing. And it absolutely terrified her because, you know, people have said, well, could she have been, you know, did somebody get into her system, onto her laptop? But the interesting thing is she kept all this to herself. And it was only when, you know, I was sort of, you know, putting the feelers out there to interview people that she contacted me. So, you know, the story that she told me was fascinating, but really weird. The idea that, you know, she was getting into all this and then she was, you know, sort of seeing the Slender Man on her laptop. But I talk in the book about how this kind of also dovetails with, you know, the theory that is the internet becoming sort of self-aware, you know, and is to the point where we start thinking about things and then it pops up on our screen, you know, that kind of thing. But she was absolutely sure that in some way or another that she had somehow either created a Tulpa thought form version of the original or that the creature itself had already been around and that Eric Knudsen himself may subconsciously have brought it forward, not realizing that that it was already sort of like a pre-existing kind of imagery. But she got rid of all her material, and when I interviewed her, she said, "No, I'm done with it." And I haven't spoken to her for a long time, but at that point, she said, you know, she was done with it. She just didn't want to have anything more to it, really. So.
Yeah, I mean, it is a whole, it's such a perplexing thing, because like you say, obviously, I think, was it Creepypasta it originated on?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I remember watching, as you touched on the case, I mean, the documentary of that, I think it's called Beware the Slender Man. That is just terrifying how that kind of magnified that situation as well, because it's just such an unusual situation that something that clearly had its origins, you know, I appreciate you touching on the possibility of a tulpa, which, you know, wouldn't be the first kind of phenomenon where something has manifested itself, sort of. But it just seemed to just spiral incredibly quickly. And people seem to become addicted to the Slender Man.
Well, that really is what happened. The timeline is 2009 when Eric Knudsen created it. You got Creepypasta. You got other people setting up blogs, chat rooms, their own fictional little stories, which were done so well, people weren't sure if it was, you know, is it actually real or is it just a story? And I think that's an important part. If you start to think, well, this could be real, it's not just fiction. And then the tip over was round about 2012. That's 2011, 2012 was when it went from being just harmless entertainment, the creepy entertainment.
Yes.
and it moved from there to where people started to say it, to see it in their bedrooms, on the internet, you know, on their laptop, out the window, that kind of thing. And it was round about that time, 2012, that you had this weird obsession really took off. Before then, it was just kind of like, you know, you click on, we all do this, you know, you click on your favorite blog or your favorite website every couple of days. It was like that, and it just started like that. But then it really went to this obsessive, almost compulsive aspect of thousands of people, predominantly kids, really seeing it as a genuine phenomenon that they could interact with. And that's what happened, you know, with the two girls in Waukesha, Wisconsin, who attacked, but fortunately, you know, didn't kill their friend. And that, you know, those two girls, you know, they're not in jail, but they're, you know, essentially they're not going to be outside of law enforcement facilities, you know, until they're middle age, and they're only about 16 now. So, you know, they've got a long future in front of them as a result. And I mean, if you watch the filmed interviews between the police officers and the two girls, I mean, it's chilling. And, you know, and they would say, oh, yeah, you know, we had to do it. You know, Slenderman said we got to do it. And, these were not girls who were like dangerous, psychotic children.
No.
They were just, you know, they've been essentially sort of brought into, you know, magnet style, you know, dragged into believing this and terrified that if they didn't have sort of a sacrifice, the Slender Man would come for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it wasn't, that was not like a cover story. That was what they genuinely thought, you know, was happening and what they had to do in response. But there's, you know, the whole issue of it taking off so quickly to the point where people believed it, that's where you have that tip over. And I think that's where, you know, we have the second Slender Man. The first Slender Man is just the piece of entertainment. And then the second version, so to speak, would be the one created out of the mind, if, of course, as you buy into Tulpas and Thought Forms, which personally I do. But, you know, I don't think it explains everything by any means. But I think it does explain some strange phenomena, which is here 1 minute and then suddenly gone. But in that period between arriving and going, there's this gigantic thrust of interest. And I think that is when the sort of the Tulpa version comes into play.
I've always found it, and you may disagree here, Nick, there seems to be, for me, the Slender Man has a lot of parallels with the Hat Man. Because they both seem to have come to life over the last 10 years. They both seem to turn up when they're least expected. There's a lot of sleep paralysis in a lot of the reports, especially for the Hat Man. And I find it interesting because they're both essentially faceless entities dressed in black appearing to people in situations where they should not be there. Do you think there is some kind of parallel between these two phenomena?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that there's several different things, or which appear different, I should say, but which are actually interconnected. And you probably know, I've written several books, I think six actually now, on the whole Men in Black and Women in Black phenomenon. Now, when people think of the Men in Black, you know, they think of Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, but that's sort of the, you know, that's the movie versions. But if you speak to most of the people who've seen or been threatened by the real Men in Black, they describe them as sort of looking pale, cadaverous, skinny, these bulging eyes, they hide behind these wraparound sunglasses. A lot of paranormal activity occurs when the MIB are in people's homes, like they feel, people start to feel weak and sick and tired. Poltergeist activity often happens in the days after the MIB visited. And you can make a good case that the Men in Black are sort of very much like a supernatural phenomenon. They're not from the Pentagon or the Ministry of Defense or nothing like that. There's something dangerously paranormal about them. But Hollywood turned them into sort of secret agents. But the reason I mention that is because the Men in Black and the Women in Black, which are very similar phenomenon, are extremely similar in terms of parallels with the Hat Man, the Shadow People, where typically all of them, whether it's the Women in Black, the Men in Black, the Hat Man, the Shadow People, you know, apart from the women, but the men, you know, the Shadow People in terms of men, the Hat Man, they're all wearing these sort of old-style suits and old-style trilby hats. And it's always black, obviously. And the women in black are typically dressed in like a black business suit, and they too wear these wraparound sunglasses, and very often like what are clearly long black wigs. So all of this is sort of, you know, very similar. And even with the so-called black-eyed children, for people who don't know, the black-eyed children are these sort of creepy kids, very pale-looking, sort of look anywhere from about 11 to 13, and they wear these black hoodies and they have these solid black eyes. You know, the whole entire eye is black. And they try and find ways into the home. And a lot of people have said, you know, they wouldn't think about letting kids who look like this, you know, pale vampire looking with black eyes into the house. But people do. And they felt with hindsight it was done with a kind of mind control, almost hypnotism. But I think all of these, the Men in Black, Women in Black, Shadow People, the Hat Man, the Black Eyed Children. I think they're all part of one bigger phenomenon, because you have the sort of classic parallels in all of them, almost, like sleep paralysis, the black outfit, you know, both the men in black and the women in black and the black-eyed children won't enter your home until they're invited, which is very much similar to the old vampire stories, you know, going back centuries. So I think in many respects, all of these are very similar. And coincidentally, just 2 days ago, I actually wrote an article between the parallels between the men in black and the Hat Man, and that'll actually be on online in a few days' time. So.
Will that be on Mysterious Universe?
Yes, it will, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always amazed. Every day I look and there's like, Nick's done another article.
Well, right, usually I do about 3 or 4 a week.
Yeah.
But I've been doing about 2 a day because, you know, with the whole virus thing, you know, you can't go here, you can't go there, you can't really do nothing. So I've just kind of amped up the number I've been doing to so I don't go crazy just staring at the wall, you know.
Yeah. Hey, well, I'm appreciated it, Nick. It's nice to get more work from you at all.
Oh, well, thanks.
So, I mean, for you next, I believe you're going to broach that subject that causes constant consternation in the world of ufology, which is Rendlesham, because obviously December this year is going to be the 40th anniversary.
Yep.
So I believe you're going to be turning your forensic mind to that particular case again.
Yeah, I've got a book out on Rendlesham, which comes out actually quite soon. I could have waited till December, which would be the precise 40th anniversary. But I figure when December comes around and it's the 40th anniversary, everybody and his brother's going to be talking about Rendlesham, you know. So I thought, and my agent and publisher Lisa thought, well, let's put it out a bit further. You know, it still technically will be in the fourth decade, you know. But so that'll be out in probably a week or so, maybe something like that. And it's quite a controversial take on the story. And but I've also got another book coming out in a few weeks' time as well. It's called Monsters of the Deep, and that's published by Visible Ink Press. And that's a long book. It's like 400 pages. But it's sort of like a comprehensive study of everything from lake monsters, sea serpents, giant squids, giant octopus, anything that sort of, you know, any kind of strange monster that lives in lakes or rivers or oceans, etc., etc. Hopefully, you know, I'll have covered pretty much them all, I hope.
Oh, fantastic. I look forward to that, because that's a subject I love, anything like sea monsters and lake monsters. It's and obviously, you know, as we touched on, I've also visited Loch Ness, though. Sadly, I didn't see anything.
Well, you know, I mean, most people who I know have been to went to Loch Ness have said something like that. Well, I went to Loch Ness, but I didn't say anything.
Yeah. I mean, end of day, I was only there 3 days.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting it to turn up
for me.
Well,
there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, one of them is the fact that, I mean, Loch Ness is like 22 miles long, about a mile wide, and about 750 feet deep. So you'd really have to be at the right place at the right time, and the creature would have to be at the right place at the right time to see that. And coincidentally, something else that I wrote about just a few days ago, and which is online now, is the theory that, for the most part, these creatures could be nocturnal. But yes, they do surface now and again, but hardly ever. So when you've got a body of water so massive, you know, 22 miles long, 750 feet deep, mile wide, that's an incredible body of water. So the chances are, you imagine, if they hardly ever surface anyway, what are the chances you're going to see it? So, I don't find that so mysterious. But, I mean, I also wrote a book on Nessie with the stunningly original name of Nessie. And that one looks at all the paranormal aspects, the weirder side of Nessie, the fact that, you know, Aleister Crowley had a house there, Beleskin House. There'd been a lot of weird stuff about people trying to photograph the creatures and the cameras jamming, Men in Black sightings at Loch Ness, weird suicides at Loch Ness, large black cats seen on the shores of Loch Ness even. So my personal view, I think the Loch Ness monsters, there's some sort of supernatural aspect to all of this. I don't think they're plesiosaurs. If they are real flesh and blood, I think they could well be. My primary theory would be like giant salamanders. There's a guy named Steve Plambeck who's got a really good blog on the theory that the Loch Ness monsters could be giant salamanders, and it sounds strange, but he puts it across really well. So either that or giant eels, but there's so much weirdness, paranormal 14 weirdness at Loch Ness, I think it kind of goes down that pathway. But because, you know, but when I bring up you know, the paranormal aspect for Nessie, you know, people say, oh, Nick's on his supernatural take. You know, well, yeah, I am, because that's what, for me, I think it is. But I never really kind of understand why so many people get kind of defensive when you start bringing into the supernatural. I mean, I see it in with Bigfoot, you know, over here. I do a lot of Bigfoot investigations, and I've got a lot of cases where people have said, you know, they've seen these creatures and they've kind of vanished in a flash of light, you know, or they were seen with all these weird glowing balls of light flitting around the creatures, you know, suggesting there's something far more or less than regular but unknown animals. And I found within the Bigfoot community, it's not just a case of people disagreeing, you know, they just think it's an unknown ape, but they actually get quite defensive and angry if you dare to say that Bigfoot is anything other than just an unknown ape. And I've never really understood that approach. I don't understand why it's a problem if it's paranormal versus flesh and blood. I mean, whatever the answer is, if we get the answer, that would be great. But I just don't, I just can't really comprehend why people do get, they get mad when you dare bring up anything other than it's just an American ape, you know, that hasn't been classified. So so that, you know, there is certainly like a degree of I want to believe in this or I want to believe in that, you know, and no room for anything in between, really. Yeah, but I don't care. I just, you know, if I think I've got something to say, I'll say it. I'm not one of these who's going to say, or should I say it in case it upsets people. I don't care if I upset people, you know. That's how it goes.
Well, if there's one thing that's ever consistent about cryptozoology, Nick, it's that there are a varied amount of camps and everybody is extremely precious about whichever camp they're in.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is, you're right, but I've never got that. I mean, I think part of it is, you know, there might be some people who want to be in with the right people. Don't rock, you know, they don't rock the boat. Well, you know, I mean, rocking the boat is something I enjoy doing, you know.
Well, sometimes it's the only way you can find the real answer.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I don't feel that. I think the worst thing you can do is shy away from your own conclusions because you're worried what your peers might say. Well, the way I look at it, that's just tough luck. You know, if somebody disagrees with me, I'm not going to lose sleep over it. What I hope is that people will think about it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think anything in, you know, the history of discovery, there will usually always be someone who comes out with a theory or a concept that is completely opposites with everybody else in that particular field, Nick, and it's happened throughout time.
Yeah, you're right. And I think, you know, I think what we should do is just look at the data, look at the evidence. I mean, even though I think that the Loch Ness creatures are, that there is some sort of supernatural aspect to it, I do believe that. However, if tomorrow, you know, there's a news flash and, you know, 30-foot long weird looking creature washed up on the shores of Loch Ness, I'll be as happy as everybody else, you know what I mean? Because it would be amazing if we actually, you know, the BBC's there filming this gigantic thing on the edge of the shore. I mean, that would be, and I'll be happy to be proved wrong, you know. I think, you know, we're all looking for answers, and some of these creatures are genuine flesh and blood. There are others which are not. And I think this is where cryptozoology as a field has kind of reached a point sometimes where people clash because, for whatever reason, egos or whatever, you know, people just cannot deal with the idea of it's supernatural or it's this or it's that, you know. And and I think we should look at all these phenomena from the perspective of what the witnesses tell us. I always tell people, you know, the most important people in these in this phenomena really aren't like the book writers or the TV companies. It's actually the witnesses, because, you know, they're the people who are telling us what they've seen. And so, you know, I think as long as we go after the evidence and the data, and as long as we don't have pre-existing, you know, theories that it's got to be this or that, we'll be okay. But, you know, just focus, do it that way. You know, don't go into something trying to prove something versus just getting the answers, you know.
Absolutely. Well, I think, as with any aspect of life, if you go into any exploration or try and discover something, Nick, and you've got a preconceived bias, mm-hmm. you will tend to drift towards the answer that suits your bias.
Mm-hmm. So, well, that does happen, yeah. I mean, I think we all should strive not to sort of, you know, have preconceived beliefs. But, I mean, but we're all human, you know. Yes. You kind of do that in all sorts of works of life, you know.
Absolutely.
But you know, hopefully one day we'll get all the answers we want. But but the way to do it, you know, is, from my perspective, is field research, really. I think you know, that's, I mean, I understand, you know, not everybody can have the time or effort or whatever, you know, to do field effort, but I think that is the way, you know, to finally, I think, get the answers.
Yeah, well, long may you continue shining a light on uncomfortable truths, Nick.
All right, well, thanks, mate.
So listen, it's been lovely to talk to you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to pick your brains on several subjects, Nick. So where can everybody keep up to date with your incredible output and forthcoming work?
Well, I have a blog called World of Whatever. So if you just Google Nick Redfern, World of Whatever, that'll take you to my blog. You can reach me at Twitter, Nick Redfern UFO. You can find me at Facebook. There's a few Nick Redferns, but you'll see me on there quite easily. And also at Amazon, there's an Amazon. I've got an Amazon page as well where you can see all the books, you know, going back to the 1990s, right up to the present. And hopefully within about a week or so, the Rendlesham Forest book should be up there as well.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put everything in the show notes as usual, Nick, and guide everybody there. So listen.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks.
Hey, my pleasure. Listen, thank you again for your time. It's been a real pleasure. I'm delighted to finally get an opportunity to pick your brain on several things. And you are always welcome whenever you'd like to come back, sir.
All right. That sounds great, Paul. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Take care.
You too. I'll see you later.